Hare Krishna. Okay, today is October the 2nd, 2007. I said last night we were going to do a little section about chanting and ghosts, but I actually changed everything around, so we're not doing that today. instead, we're going to move on to temple and airport greetings. Of course, when you were traveling with Srila Prabhupada, then every day was a festival, literally. Yeah. I remember at least when I was in Australia, up until I left there in 75, but 72, 73, 74, and 75, Prabhupada came. And just for that 1 week, that was the big festival of the year when Prabhupada visited. And every day was literally a festival. We would, you know, of course, attend Prabhupada's lectures. If you were lucky, you would get out on a morning walk. And every evening, there'd be a feast. And there'd, you know, be very big kirtans because everybody was so happy that Srila Prabhupada was visiting. So, because when you were on Prabhupada's party, then everywhere you went, you were going into that situation. So literally every day was a festival, practically. Except sometimes in India, where, you know, the temples weren't quite as big. And Prabhupada was also much more involved in the management here. In fact, totally involved in the management here. And so it was a slightly different mood. But anyway, so naturally enough, there were a lot of occasions, you know, for some very exuberant chanting wherever Prabhupada went on his travels. So one example, of course, is when he arrived here in Mayapur on January the 17th, 1976. And that was a special occasion. There was a large gathering of ISKCON Mayapur devotees led by Bhavananda and Sudama Maharajas, who were eagerly awaiting Srila Prabhupada to greet him when we arrived at about 11 a.m. You have to excuse me, I've got a bit of indigestion from the lunch. As we approached, we saw that the construction of a beautiful and impressive gatehouse had been completed at the entrance to our property. The gatehouse is 15 feet thick with three archways. The center archway is wide enough and high enough for a truck to pass under, while the two side ones are for pedestrians. Above the archway sit five domes, the large central one capped with an ornate brass spire reaching some 50 feet or more into the air. There are several small rooms in the domes on either side. The entire structure is attractively painted, the domes in saffron and maroon with yellow on the facing wall. Large footprints of Lord Chaitanya adorned with tulsi leaf sprigs and surrounded by lotus flowers are emblazoned on the front, with the words Sri Mayapur Chandradaya Mandir written below them. Prabhupada got out of the car on the front main road. As everybody looked on in great delight, he stepped forward and cut a large ribbon, officially opening the gateway. The formal ceremony over, the metal gates were opened, and he happily walked through the arch and entered the temple compound, followed by a stream of devotees. He moved steadily along the road past the original thatched hut where he had first stayed when he got the land, past the flower beds and crops towards the main building. All the while he was surrounded by dancing, chanting party of about 20 or 30 young Bengali brahmacharis, all Vaishnavs, heads shaven and decorated with tilak, loudly chanting Hare Krishna. These are all the privileged residents of Lord Chaitanya's holy dham, whose greatest joy in life is clearly the presence of the Lord's pure devotee. Entering the ground floor temple room, Prabhupada greeted the beautiful brass forms of Sri Sri Radha Madhava. Sri Shalagram Srila is also present, Mayapur being one of the few ISKCON temples in which Srila Prabhupada has so far sanctioned his worship. After a lively Guru Puja, Prabhupada gave a short talk describing the benefits of life in the Holy Dharma. It was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's aspiration that the Europeans, Americans and Indians all together dance jubilantly and chant Gaura Hari. So this temple, Mayapur Chandradaya Temple, is meant for transcendental United Nations. What the United Nations has failed, that will be achieved here by the process recommended by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Prativa Chaya Chay Jato, Nagaradi Gram, Sabatra Prachar Hoyabe, Mornam. So you have come from all parts of the world and are living together in this temple. So train these small boys. I am very glad especially to see the small children from all other countries and Indian, Bengalis, all together, forgetting their bodily consciousness. That is the greatest achievement in this movement, that everybody forgets the bodily conception of life. Nobody thinks of themselves here as European, American, Indian, Hindu, Muslim, Christian. They forget all these designations, and simply they are ecstatic in chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. So, kindly do what you have begun. Do not break it. Continue it very jubilantly. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the master of Mayapur, he will be very much pleased upon you. And ultimately, you will go back to home, back to Godhead. Thank you very much. So, very nice arrival speech there. And that became a feature every day. There was a Gurukul that was at that time situated on the front wall. And all little Bengalis, practically most of them. I don't think any of them were probably older than about 7 or 8 years, because it was just beginning at that time. And every day they would be brought down for the morning program at about 7 o'clock, just before Prabhupada greeted the deities, and they come marching down from the front gate there, down this main, our main road, and they'd all be in a line, and then they would be chanting the Gita Gan. The Gita Gan, of course, is a book that Prabhupada wrote. It's the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, but written in rhyming Bengali. And Prabhupada said he wrote it in such a way that it's not possible to misinterpret it. So he wrote that as a poem, the whole Bhagavad Gita in Bengali. And then all the boys, they were all learning the Gita Gan. So as they came marching down the road, one of them would be at the front. It's a bit like when you see the movies with the American Marines, and they're all in, you know, rank and file, and they're marching along, and one of them's yelling out some slogan, and then all the others repeat it. It's a bit like Sankirtan. So that's what they were doing. There was one boy at the beginning, and he would yell out, you know, there's one of the lines from the Gita Gan, and then all the little boys behind, they would all yell it out as loud as they could. And like that, they were coming down, singing the Gita Gan. And Prabhupada would, sometimes he would come out on the balcony and watch them, and he would smile like anything to see them. So it was very nice. And also they used to sometimes line up just in the Lotus building there where the steps are. Then they'd be all waiting for Prabhupada to come down and to go into the temple room. And they would sing a particular tune. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Every day, same tune. That became known as the Mayapur Gurukul tune. It was very beautiful, very nice. Okay, so that was Mayapur. We had a very interesting greeting when Prabhupada flew from Bombay to Melbourne. He left Bombay on April the 18th, early morning, and we flew actually to Singapore. We had a stop over there for a few hours. Then there was also a delay because the plane, something was wrong with the plane. And then we flew overnight We landed in Sydney the next morning on the 19th of April. We had an hour stopover there. Then we flew on another hour to Melbourne. So by the time we got to Melbourne, we'd been actually traveling about 22 hours, you know, from the time that we'd left Brisbane. So I'm in Bombay, so you can imagine, you know, the strain that that was. Anyway, so just before landing, this is in Melbourne, we had to fill out the customary landing cards, which also required a list of baggage. Without thinking carefully, we filled out Prabhupada's card, indicating that he had one suitcase. Once off the plane, we passed through immigration without difficulty, and we entered into the baggage hall. We decided that Srila Prabhupada and I would go directly through the customs, carrying only his red attaché case, and Pushtakrishna Swami would bring the suitcases. However, the customs officer insisted that Prabhupada had to wait for the suitcase, which was indicated on his form. I pleaded strongly with the man to allow Prabhupada to please allow Prabhupada to go through immediately. I assured him that I would wait and take full responsibility for the suitcase. I pointed out that there were no chairs for Prabhupada to sit down on, and it would take at least half an hour more for the bags to come off the plane. I said that Prabhupada was over 80 years old, and he'd been traveling for so many hours, and it was unnecessary for him to make him wait. I had packed the bags for him anyway. Despite my best attempts, the customs official was utterly uncooperative and refused to allow Prabhupada to go through. The discussion became heated as my temper rose. A small crowd of passengers gathered around to see what the disturbance was. So I started getting really annoyed with this guy and I started yelling at him. Srila Prabhupada just walked away and stood quietly to the side. He didn't tell me to stop, he just kind of wandered off to one side and, you know, pretended he wasn't with me. The official was obdurate. He returned to his post, leaving me standing there fuming. 2 minutes later, an airport policeman approached me to ask what was going on. I explained that we simply wanted Srila Prabhupada to be allowed to go straight through customs without his bag. He asked me, "Is all that going on because of him?" That was the loud roar of a tremendous Harinam Kirtan which was coming through the doors leading into the arrival hall. The Kirtan could be clearly heard above all the airport noise and the public address announcements. Guru Kripa Swami and a large number of devotees were excitedly banging kartals, beating mridangas, and chanting so loudly that the airport officials had moved them away from the main greeting area. But still, the sound drowned out everything else. With every opening and closing of the doors, the intense chanting boomed louder and then receded. The sounds of the holy names uplifted us, and when Prabhupada heard it, he inquired innocently, "This is our man?" It couldn't have been anybody else. The airport security personnel were somewhat bewildered as to how to handle the situation. "Will they stop if he goes through?" the policeman asked. I assured him, "Yes, they will." And within seconds, Prabhupada was allowed to pass through, leaving Pushtakrishna and myself to wait for the bags. As Prabhupada disappeared through the door and was spotted by the devotees, the kirtan reached a terrific crescendo with loud shouts of "Jai Prabhupada!" Then the noise stopped abruptly and Prabhupada was taken into the VIP lounge where the devotees had arranged a press conference. So a footnote on that was that after Prabhupada went through, then a few minutes later the bags came onto the, you know, the, what they call it, the carousel. So I got Prabhupada's bag, and then I was thinking, now this, you know, I'm going to go through the customs, this guy's going to give me a really hard time. But instead, they directed me to another man. And he told me, you know, to put the suitcase on the bench there. And he had obviously seen what had happened, you know, with the other guy. So he went out of his way to be extra nice. So, you know, he said, oh, you know, welcome to Melbourne. Hope you have a good stay. I've just got to check your bag. It'll only take a minute, like this. So, you know, he was being really nice. So I thought, okay, I was relieved. Otherwise, I was thinking they're going to go through everything, you know. So anyway, he unzips Prabhupada's suitcase. It was a soft top one. And he unzipped it. And as he lifted up the lid, a cockroach about 2 inches long leapt out from underneath the lid onto the bench. And that was it. All hell broke loose. The guy, as soon as he saw it, he yelled out, quarantine, quarantine, like this. And there was this big post at the end of the bench, and it had this red flashing light. It wasn't on, but it had a big button on it, and he whacked the button, and this thing starts to flash. And then this klaxon starts going off, brr, 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 like this. He's yelling for the quarantine. And this cockroach is running around in circles on his bench. So instead of waiting for the other guys to come, he takes off his shoe and he goes whack. And he flattens the cockroach right on the bench. And I thought, oh, this is it. Now I'm finished. You know, I'm going to be here for an hour. You know, he's going to go through everything. He's going to take everything out, you know. Anyway, so this other guy, by this time, he'd run up. He had two really big cans of bug spray. And he passed them to the officer there. And then he grabs them, and he had one in each hand. He looks at me, he said, this will just take a minute. And he goes, shh, like this. And he lets all the bug cans, until they're empty, he just sprays them into Prabhupada's suitcase. And then he slams the lid down and he zipped it up. He said, all right. He said, have a nice stay. So that was a... We had some memorable incidences in airports. But that was probably the most memorable, that one. Okay. Then, so we were there for a week in Melbourne. And then on the 26th, then we flew off to Auckland. So as they had when Prabhupada had arrived, the devotees gave him a rousing send-off, chanting and dancing all around him, right up to the aeroplane door. As he went down the escalator, the devotees kept abreast by running down the up escalator. So Prabhupada was going down, so they all ran down the one that was coming up next to him so they could keep up with him. And Prabhupada grinned to see their enthusiasm. At the plane, he turned and waved to them as he entered, flashing a brilliant smile to show his appreciation, causing them to jump and shout with happiness. So in those days, of course, you could actually go with a big kirtan party into the airports, and basically nobody would stop you. They would try, but it was like a whole new thing. They'd never dealt with anything like that before. And we used to get away with it, and you could actually go all the way up to where they actually entered onto the plane. Now, of course, with all the security, you can hardly even get into the building, what to speak about, you know, get down to the aeroplanes. Okay, so then we had a three-hour flight to Auckland, and there was a three-hour time difference. So it was 10 p.m. when our Air New Zealand flight touched down in Auckland. There at the airport to greet Srila Prabhupada were 50 or 60 jubilantly chanting devotees with drums, kartals, and guitars. It was quite a heterogeneous crowd, most of them from Tusta Krishna Swami's group. The local ISKCON temple has only about 12 men and women. On the way to the temple, cars and vans packed with excited devotees were speeding ahead, and as they went past us, they were waving and smiling out of the windows and shouting, Jai Srila Prabhupada, as they passed. So then we were only there a day and a half, and Prabhupada did some initiations. He installed some deities, and then on the 28th morning, then again, we were flying out and we were going to Fiji. So there was a big send-off at the airport. As we waited for our flight, Srila Prabhupada sat serene and stately as the entire assembly of devotees settled in a large semicircle on the floor in front of him. An atmosphere of blissful tranquility seemed to envelop the gathering as everyone took a last darshan of his divine grace. Hari Ramadas, a former rock group member, now with Tusta Krishna, began to play his guitar and chant Hare Krishna to a gentle, lilting melody. Guru Kripa Swami began to play karatals softly as an accompaniment. But Srila Prabhupada, however, stopped him and allowed the boy to sing solo for a few minutes as he listened with obvious pleasure. Smiling broadly, Prabhupada gave him his garland. In this way, he encouraged Tushtakrishna's men to continue with their chanting, knowing that as long as they did this, even if they never agreed to cooperate with ISKCON, they will continue to be purified and make some spiritual advancement. He is their spiritual master, and he wants to keep them somehow or another connected. When the time came to depart, everyone followed his divine grace right to the boarding gate, all chanting along the way. And our plane departed for Nandi, Fiji, at 11 a.m. So that was nice. That was a contrast. Instead of a big roaring kirtan, there was just this one boy. He started playing his guitar, and then Prabhupada, oh yes, and he just let him play it for like a few minutes. It was very nice. So then the next big airport greeting was the following month. We had a week in Fiji, then we had a month in Hawaii. Of course, in Fiji, nobody was there except Vasudev and Upendra, and that was it. And then in Hawaii, there was a small party that greeted Prabhupada as he arrived there. But then the next big one was when we flew from Hawaii to Los Angeles. So this was on the evening of June the 1st in 1976. So as the plane taxied into Los Angeles International Airport, the pilot made a special announcement. He informed us that because of an especially crowded arrival lounge, anyone who had no one waiting to meet them could exit via a specially arranged bypass. What he didn't tell us was that the lounge was packed with about 500 eager, expectant devotees all waiting to see Srila Prabhupada. So they'd come from all over the West Coast and beyond. The flight to the West Coast had taken 4.5 hours, so with the time adjustment, it was 9 p.m. when we arrived in Los Angeles. So as we were getting off the plane, I forgot to put this in, but we were standing, you know, waiting for them to open the door, and then they made this announcement that, you know, there's some congestion in the airport, so if you don't have anybody who's waiting for you, you can take this special bypass. So, you know, they didn't say what the congestion was, so we just naturally were starting to follow everybody else. And then the air hostess, she said, not you, you go this way. Like this. So we went off, you know, the regular route, and then when we came into the, you know, the arrival lounge, which is quite big at LAX, there's 500 devotees there all going wild. So Tamal Krishna, Ridayananda, Trivik Ram, and Rameshwara Swamis, and Jagadish Prabhu greeted Srila Prabhupada, each bearing luxurious flower garlands of varying lengths, including one that reached right down to his ankles. As they placed them around his neck, the rest of the devotees, out of spontaneous affection, erupted with sheer ecstasy to see him. The long walk down the passenger concourse was tumultuous, with devotees chanting and dancing with sublime abandon, jostling to catch a glimpse of the pure devotee of the Supreme Lord. As he traveled along the moving walkways, Srila Prabhupada appeared like the full moon crossing the night sky, surrounded by an entourage of bright stars, all gathered to pay homage to their Lord and Master. In reciprocation, he raised his hand high up into the air, grinning broadly, his teeth flashing in the light. The devotees went wild with delight. The walls reverberated with the boom of drums and the clash of karatals, and the transcendental vibration of the holy names turned the ordinary airport fixtures and surroundings into Vaikuntha. It was the biggest reception LAX had ever seen, and Srila Prabhupada very humbly accepted the tremendous accolade with folded hands and greetings of Hare Krishna and Jai. And then, of course, when we got to the temple, the car pulled up at the curb, and it's probably about 50 meters back to the temple entrance, and they put a red carpet, you know, from the pavement there all the way into the temple. And then as Prabhupada entered, then there's a mezzanine floor in the entrance just above your head when you first come in. So all the ladies would gone up there, And as he approached the temple, they were up in the windows, and as Prabhupada came underneath, they started throwing flower petals on him. And then as he came in and then out from underneath the mezzanine floor, it was just like huge, just like we do the, you know, pushpa flower bathing of the deities here, but just huge clouds. It was like a blizzard. Prabhupada was walking through, he was looking like this. He was really happy. It's very nice. Okay, then the next one that we had, big one, was when we arrived in New York. Because from LA we went to Detroit. Again, there was about 300 devotees that saw him off at the airport. We arrived in Detroit. We went to Toronto. Then we came to Pittsburgh and New Brindaban. Then we went to Washington, D.C. And then finally, on July the 9th, then we flew up to New York. So Prabhupada arrived at LaGuardia Airport at 10 a.m. to a fantastic reception, equal in enthusiasm, if not scale, to his Los Angeles arrival. Tamal Krishna Goswami, Tripurari Swami, and Rameshwara Swami garlanded him as he came off the plane, forming a saffron escort through the departure lounge. Now in New York, they did actually stop the devotees from going all the way in, so just the sannyasis came through. But then, as soon as they came out of the immediate arrival area, then all the devotees were there. About 200 devotees greeted him with unbounded enthusiasm, which required the presence of a special police contingent to disperse any congestion in the airport. Hemangadas held a large, elaborately decorated ceremonial umbrella over Prabhupada's head. The Bhakti Rasa theater group danced all around him, and everyone else threw flowers and chanted Hare Krishna as Prabhupada made his way to the car, pausing only to answer a few questions from the reporters. It was both colorful and exciting to watch His Divine Grace stride through the airport like a person returning home after a long absence, looking confident and happy, wreathed in multicolored roses. So there were a few other nice receptions and greetings that we had, but they were the main ones on that last world tour there. Because we, as I mentioned, it was kind of interesting whenever we went through the customs, there was always some incident practically everywhere that we went. Melbourne was the first one. Then in Hawaii, when we landed there, then we were practically strip searched, not quite, but all our bags. Me and Pusta Krishna, you know, we stayed with the bags. We made sure that Prabhupada could get through straight away. And they kept us there for half an hour. They searched every single bit of baggage that we had. They were feeling the linings and everything. And we found out later it was because some so-called devotees had been busted smuggling drugs through the Hawaii customs. So, you know, they were on the alert, any Hare Krishnas. Stop them and search them. And also Guru Kripa Maharaj, he used to travel with his, he had these very small Gaunatai deities that were made from, I think they're either made from gold or they were dipped in pure gold. And they wore real diamonds, real emeralds, rubies, sapphires. I mean, they were decked out in about $30,000 worth of jewelry. So the customs seized that one time and then accused them that they were smuggling jewels as well. It took them a long time to get it all back, but eventually they got it. So that was a problem going through Hawaii. The mainland, of course, was no problem. But I was surprised that when we went from America to Canada, we flew from Detroit to Toronto. You know, I was thinking I'd heard the Canadians are nice people, very mellow. Like this. But actually when we went through the customs, they were really nasty. Again, the same thing. Myself and Prabhupada left the baggage to Pushta Krishna to bring through, and Prabhupada just had his little attaché case. So that attaché case, that had whatever was utilized on Prabhupada's desk. When we packed, and you know, we were leaving somewhere, I would pack all the suitcases, Then all the stuff that was on Prabhupada's desk, that was left till the last moment. Then Prabhupada would, you know, go in and tell Prabhupada, now we're ready to go. So Prabhupada would get up, he would go out the door, I'd give him his cane, put his shoes on, he would start walking out, and then I'd run back with this attaché case, and everything that was on his desk, I'd grab it all and throw it all inside. And then I'd run after, you know, run out afterwards. And then the trick was that when you arrived in the next place, then before Prabhupada got into his room, I'd run inside, open up the attaché case, put everything out on his desk, so that it was exactly as it was from when he last left the last place. So he'd come in and sit down and everything would be there. So anyway, Prabhupada used to have, we had a couple of these small tins of snuff. So snuff, of course, it's a medicinal for high blood pressure. If you sniff it, it apparently helps you to relieve high blood pressure. I remember my grandfather was always snorting snuff. Nowadays they snort cocaine, but in those days they used to sniff snuff. Yeah, that's why it's called snuff. So you just put some on the back of your hand and like this. So Prabhupada used to take it medicinally sometimes. So anyway, we had a couple of little flat cans, and I had sealed them with wax because I didn't want them to burst open in Prabhupada's case. So when we were coming out from the Toronto airport there, we went through the passport control, no problem. But then we came to the customs, and then there were two or three customs officials there. And then this one man, he was a tall, sneering, you know, horrible person. And I could see he was going to give us problems. So all the devotees, they were just on the outside, and there was like a glass wall. So, you know, you could see from the customs outside and people inside, they could see all the passengers coming out. So there's this big crowd there, you know, all excited, waiting for Prabhupada. So they must have been there for some time. And this customs official apparently didn't like devotees. So when he got Prabhupada's case, he opened it up and he took out every single item. Everything. And he had it all laid out there and he was looking really slowly and carefully at it. And then at one point he looked up and he turned to his friend and he looked at Srila Prabhupada. He said, so this is what they're all waiting for. He was really nasty. I felt like smacking him, but of course... I didn't lose my temper like I did in the Australian airport because I thought they might not let me in if I did. But anyway, it wasn't very nice. And even the tins of snuff, he took off all the wax seals so that he could have a look inside, just to, you know, harass us. Anyway, so that was Canada. Then the next country that we flew into was London. London was also a problem because when we left, it was an evening flight and Prabhupada had already got a really heavy cold. He had just done an initiation ceremony for about 200 devotees the day before. And I saw whenever Prabhupada did a big initiation, he would get some kind of physical illness just shortly afterwards. So, you know, a cold or toothache or something. So... he got a very, very heavy cold. And all the GBC came up to Prabhupada's room just before we were leaving and, you know, requested him to stay in New York until he recovered his health. But Prabhupada said, no, they've, you know, arranged programs, so I should go. So even the airlines, they advise you, if you have a cold, not to fly because the pressurized cabin, if you have too much mucus in your system, it makes you dizzy. And then the likelihood is that you'll throw up. So anyway, Prabhupada went. And the whole evening flight, I think they lower the temperature a little bit on the planes as well in the night time so that you sleep. So the whole flight, Prabhupada spent it lying down and just coughing up all this heavy mucus every few minutes. And when we flew into London, we got there early in the morning. Guru Das Maharaj was with us at that time. So Prabhupada called him. He said, when we arrive, he said, you get me a wheelchair. So for Prabhupada to ask for a wheelchair meant that he was very, very sick. Because, you know, Prabhupada was a very self-sufficient person. He liked to do things on his own, you know, and when because he allowed us to render him some service. But, you know, he was quite a strong, determined personality. So for him to ask for a wheelchair to get him off the plane meant he was very seriously ill. So anyway, we arrived. Gurudas went off to try to get a wheelchair arranged. In the meantime, Prabhupada was sitting there, and after a couple of minutes, he just didn't want to sit there anymore. So he got up and he walked off the airplane and started walking down the corridors of Heathrow Airport. Heathrow has very long corridors. I mean, it's a very big airport. The corridors are really long. And Prabhupada just started walking. And as he was walking, he was swaying. He was dizzy. And he was swaying from side to side. So I was walking right behind him, you know, with my hands out, just in case he fell over or something, or collapsed. So after we'd gone about maybe 100 meters or more than that, Gurudas came running up behind us, and he said, "Prabhupada, they've got the wheelchair, but," he said, "they won't let me bring it here. You have to go back to the aeroplane and get on it at the aeroplane." And Prabhupada he didn't say anything, he just shook his head and kept on walking. Now, and they were so obstinate. I mean, what was the harm in bringing the wheelchair 50 or 100 meters? But they wouldn't do it. Rules. Anyway, after a few yards, then two policemen came. And they kind of fell in behind us, about 10 meters behind us. And they followed us all the way in, up into the immigration. So I presume that they've been told that there's a potential problem here, you know, with a passenger that's sick. So just stay with them and check. So they didn't say anything, and they didn't come close, but they just, you know, kind of shadowed us all the way up to the immigration counter. So it was quite a walk. Anyway, so when we got to the immigration counter, finally there was somewhere for Srila Prabhupada to sit down. So I asked him, "Please sit here, I'll go with the passports." Then the policemen came up, and they were stood right next to Prabhupada. So I went up to the counter, and there was this young guy there. He was probably about the same age as me, about 24, 25, like that. And, you know, he kind of looks at me like this, and he looks at Prabhupada like this. He's looking down the end of his nose, you know. And I got Prabhupada's passport, and he had a double passport. And his British visa was actually in his old passport, not in the new section. You know, they'd added a section on. So, you know, it was quite thick. So to save time, I passed the passport to the guy, and I said, "Now the passport's here at the back. It's in this section here at the front." So he took it, and he puts it down, face down, and then he opens the back of the passport, and then one by one, really slowly, he starts opening up the pages and looking on either side, although I'd told him where the visa was. So I got so frustrated, I took it off him, and I opened it straight up to the visa, and I put it back down. I said, "It's there." And he flipped. He got so annoyed, he grabbed his rubber stamp, and he shoved it in my face. He said, "Here, go on, stamp it, go on. Why don't you stamp it too?" Like this. And I was like, "Who is this guy?" You know? And I looked around, and I saw the policemen were looking over. And then the guy, he saw the cops were looking at him, and then he cooled down a bit. So then, you know, he was trying to show me he was the boss, you know. So anyway, then he stamps the visa, passes it back to me, and he says, "Here, ain't he the bloke that wrote the Bhagavad Gita?" He's a Cockney. And I was amazed. I was thinking, how this guy knows that Prabhupada wrote the Bhagavad Gita? I was thinking, this guy's a real demon, you know. And I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "How did you know that?" He said, "I bought one on Oxford Street." So amazingly enough, he'd bought a Bhagavad Gita, and he recognized Prabhupada from his picture in the Gita. He must have had a really good look at it. I mean, he had a good memory. So I thought, well, anyway, this is a chance for this demon to you know, rectify himself. So I said, yes. I said, and he's going to be speaking on the Bhagavad Gita at our place near Watford at Lechmore Heath. So you're invited. Please come. You know, all right. I don't know whether he ever came, but anyway. So that was an interesting reception in London. The devotees were all there, but Prabhupada was so sick. As soon as we came out, I told Jaitirtha, no reception, nothing. We just have to get in the car and go. So they brought the car up, Mr. Charles Patel. He had his Rolls Royce. And Prabhupada got in the back with Jaitirtha. I got in the front with Harikesh Swami, who was there to greet us, and he was just coming on as the new secretary, Pushyakrishna, we left behind in America. And then on the way to, because in those days there was no M25, so it was quite a long drive to get to the manor from Heathrow. And we had to stop twice so that Prabhupada could throw up. He was sitting in the back and he was so sick. The first time he told us to stop, and we stopped and opened the door and he threw up. Then after a few minutes we were able to go on. And then after a couple of minutes I turned round to see how he was doing. Jaitirtha was sitting right next to him, but he was spacing out for some reason or another. And I saw Prabhupada was sitting there and he was like going through the motions of vomiting, but without actually doing it. He was like dry retching. And with his hand, he was going like this and retching. And nothing was coming out. So immediately I told the driver, stop, stop. We stopped again and then Prabhupada threw up again. And then we got to the manor after about maybe an hour and a half. And Prabhupada went straight to bed. And virtually he spent the next two or three days in bed, just resting. And not taking his massage, and not having any bath either, except just like a sponge bath. Because he just had a really heavy flu. And he was even thinking at that point he was just going to fly straight back to Bombay. And he had Harikesh actually look up the airline schedules to see if we could change the tickets. Because we were supposed to go to France, and from France to Tehran, and then on to Bombay. But Prabhupada, you know, he didn't like the weather in England. It was too cold for him. And he said if he got back to Bombay, the climate suited him there, and he would, you know, recover more quickly. But as it turned out, there were no bookings to be had. There was hardly any planes in those days, of course, that used to come to India except Air India. And Air India was always completely booked up. So we couldn't get any bookings for at least a week or so. So then Prabhupada said, all right, then we'll just leave it for now. Then Bhagavan, he was in France. He heard Prabhupada might not come there, so he flew straight over. And then he talked very nicely to Prabhupada, and he persuaded him that actually the weather in France is much better than England. It's very nice. It's very warm. We have beautiful quarters for you at New Mayapur. You'll be very happy. You'll get very fit and strong. So like that, Prabhupada allowed him to talk him into staying. And so we went to France. So then that was the next incident. So we left London. We went on a TriStar jet to Paris. And Charles de Gaulle Airport, they have these Perspex tubes with moving walkways in them. Like when you arrive, then you go through these big tubes through the middle of the airport. It's kind of very weird. And they have these moving walkways. So when we got on the plane in London, Prabhupada always traveled first class. And his servant also traveled first class as well. And then all the rest of the party, which at that time was Harikesh, Prajumna, his wife, Rundati, and son, Aniruddha, they were all on the party. So they were all in economy. So the first class seats were right next to the entrance to the plane. So we'd gotten on and we were sitting there. And then, you know, the passengers were coming on and they were queuing up, waiting to pass further down into economy. So this man came on and I saw him look at me. He kind of gave me a piercing look. I didn't think much about it. And then, you know, the guy was in the queue, and then after about a minute, he came up level with me. And just as he came up level with me, he leaned right over and he got about this far from my face and he said, "How are you, Harry?" Like this. And then, that was it. He was gone. He went down the back. A really nasty guy. An American. So, not a comment on the Americans, but it was an American in Paris. Right, you know that one. anyway, so that was it. I didn't think about anything more about it. Prabhupada didn't really kind of register it. And so it was like an hour's flight or something, and then we were in Paris. So we get off the plane, and we were the first ones off, because we were right up at the front. Harry Keshe ran out and caught up with us, and then we got on the moving walkway. So I was in front, Prabhupada was just behind me, and Harry Keshe was behind him. So we're about halfway along the moving walkway, and all of a sudden I hear all this, "Gar! Ah!" like this, and all yelling and screaming. And Harry Keshe is yelling, and then it's this guy. And he's yelling and screaming, and effing this, and swearing his head off, like this. And they both come kind of tumbling past me, right? And somehow or another, their bags are locked together, their shoulder bags. And the guy's, you know, struggling with Harry Keshe. Harry Keshe is, you know, squaring off to him. And then all of a sudden, they become disentangled, and the guy goes zooming off at top speed, you know, along the walkway. And he's yelling his head off and swearing at us. And that was the last that we saw of him. So I turned around. I was, "What's going on?" And Harry Keshe told me, he said, "I was just standing there." He said, "Now all of a sudden I just got this intuition that I should move forward and protect Srila Prabhupada." And he said, "Just as I did this, this guy came zooming up behind and tried to barge into Srila Prabhupada from behind." And he said, "Instead of hitting Prabhupada, he hit me." And then they got all tangled up, and then he was off. Anyway, so that was another interesting airport experience. No problem from the customs and immigration in France, fortunately. Then the next place we went to was Iran, where I wasn't sure what kind of a, you know, reception we'd get there, but actually it was the best one that we had, because Atreya Rishi, somehow or another, he went right inside the customs area. He spoke to some of the officials there. And then when Prabhupada came off the plane, we walked across the tarmac into the terminal. Atreya Rishi was there to greet us even before we went through the immigration. He said, "Please sit down, give me your passports." We sat down, he went off with the passports. He came back a minute later, all stamped, no problem, when we were straight through. We didn't even see the immigration officials or the customs. It arranged it so that the bags came through without being checked and everything. So that was very nice. So anyway, that was a few international dealings. Prabhupada always said, when we were in New Vrindavan, we were driving out to go on a walk. So they were going to drop us in some place. So as we were going along, there were some dogs at the side of the road, and they started barking as they do, you know, when the cars go past. And so they're barking very loudly, and Prabhupada, he turned and he grinned, he said, "Immigration department." Prabhupada had a good sense of humor. Okay, more chanting experiences with Srila Prabhupada. The next really nice one was when we went down. In December of 76, we'd gone down to Hyderabad for the second time that year, and we spent 2 weeks on the farm. And then from there, we were going by train overnight up to Wardha. Wardha is right exactly in the middle of the country in Maharashtra. If you look at the map, it's practically dead center. And it's just like an 8-hour train ride up from Secunderabad. 8 or 10 hours. And Prabhupada had been invited there to attend what was called the Gita Pratishthan meeting. I mentioned this before in class. It was a 2 or 3 day event, and it was being hosted by Ramkrishna Bajaj, who owns this, he's dead now, but they owned this Bajaj factories, electrical goods, fans, scooters, motor rickshaws, all that stuff. So big man. And he had also been personally, practically brought up, you know, under the wing of M.K. Gandhi, because his father was one of the main supporters of Gandhi, and their headquarters was in Wardha. And Gandhi had made his ashram in a small village just next to Wardha. So we were going up there, they were having this Gita Pratishthan to discuss how to popularize the Bhagavad Gita in India. And people from different spiritual groups had been invited to attend, and of course Prabhupada had been invited. And so we went up there overnight then after being in Hyderabad. This was on December the 18th. So after a comfortable night's rest, we awoke early in the morning at around 5 a.m. Srila Prabhupada was already sitting up chanting on his beads. So it was me, Hansaduta, Jagadish and Srila Prabhupada. One by one we filed out to brush our teeth and bathe. Finally, Srila Prabhupada himself went out to wash. And when he came back, we happily sat opposite and chanted our Gayatri mantras along with him. Then, asking for his kartals, Prabhupada softly began to chant the Mangalacharana prayers, beginning with Om Agyane Timirandasya Gananjana Salakaya and Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam, etc. At first, he sang solo, and then when he began to sing the Govastakam prayers, the prayers glorifying the spiritual master, he indicated for us to join in. He led, and the three of us responded, first with the prayers to the spiritual master, and then on to the Panchatattva Maha Mantra, and then the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and then finally finishing with Krishnaut Kirtanagan and Artana Paro from the Sri Sad Goswami Astak. It was a rare and sublime moment, blissful and intimate, to have Srila Prabhupada not only sitting just 3 feet away as we sang our daily prayers of appreciation and glorification of him, but to have him take the lead in doing so. It struck me that just as we were meditating on him as the object of our affection and gratitude, he was also deeply absorbed in meditating on his Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Somehow, it increased my sense of connection with the Guru Parampara. Not minding that he only had an audience of 3, Prabhupada then gave a class for 15 minutes from the first verse of the 7th canto of the Bhagavatam. Finally, he eased back in his seat, and we all chanted on our beads until our arrival in Wardha at 8:25 a.m. So, you know, even though I'd been with Prabhupada just over a year at that point, there were some occasions that, you know, really struck you as being a little special. And that was one of them, with Prabhupada just sitting there, just very softly, playing his kartals and chanting all the morning prayers. And we were, you know, responding. And, you know, it was so nice singing the Govastakam prayers with Prabhupada sitting right there in front of us. And then I had this realization that as we're thinking of Prabhupada, he's thinking of his Prabhupada. And it was just really nice. Anyway, so as our train slowly eased to a halt, Prabhupada was delighted to observe a large group of our Bombay devotees and local people gathered on the platform, enthusiastically chanting Hare Krishna in anticipation of his arrival. Stepping down from the carriage, Prabhupada was gratified to be received by Mr. Ramkrishna Bajaj, the wealthy industrialist who has convened the event, and with him his brother-in-law Sriman Narayan, a former governor of Gujarat, who is the current president of the Gita Pratishthan. Prabhupada was taken to an open horse-drawn carriage. Mounting it with Hansaduta Maharaj and myself, he was taken in procession to the town, the Kirtan party preceding. Although it was only a couple of miles, it took more than an hour and 15 minutes. We stopped frequently, as all along the entire route, people came out of their houses to offer their respects, with small trays arrayed with ghee lamps, flowers, kumkum, and uncooked rice, The excited and reverential townsfolk came forward to mount the side of the carriage, dot Prabhupada's forehead with the kumkum and rice, wave their lamps, and deposit a few paisa as a token of their veneration. This is the traditional way in India to offer worshipful respect to a great personality, and we thought it just befitting the arrival of His Divine Grace. On reaching the town center, we drew slowly down the narrow main street as thousands of people appeared on both sides, on the balconies and rooftops, showering down flowers and petals to honor Krishna's pure devotee and the foreign bhaktas. Srila Prabhupada received their accolades with humble disposition, patiently sitting, the palms of his hands pressed together in pranams, as eager onlookers clamored to garland him. It was a wonderful spectacle and experience. Finally, we stopped outside a Lakshmi Narayan temple on Bachdaraj Road, which operates under the auspices of the Bajaj family. The two-story mandir is not an elaborate monument, but while being little bigger than a small residential apartment block, it became famous in India as the first temple to allow the lower castes, or Harijans as Gandhi renamed them, full rights of access in 1928. The temple was packed as Prabhupada entered first through the arch of the 10-feet thick gatehouse and then into the temple proper. He was pleased to see many more of his disciples, including Jaipataka Swami, Gurudas Swami, Gopal Krishna Prabhu and Giriraj Prabhu. Prabhupada moved forward to the deity room to offer his obeisances to the 4 feet high white marble presiding deities of Sri Sri Lakshmi Narayan, who stand on a waist height marble altar. While not elaborately dressed by ISKCON standards, the resplendent and majestic four-armed lord and his eternal consort looked well cared for. After receiving Charanamrita, Prabhupada was invited to the side of the temple room to sit in a large armchair-like Vyasasan. For the next half hour, he happily held court, surrounded by his disciples, while Hansaduta Maharaj led us in Kirtan, much to the delight and amazement of hundreds of locals. Prabhupada was very pleased with the whole reception. So that was very similar to when we had arrived the year before in Sanand. And we'd gone down the main street on this horse and carriage, and all thousands of people came out. And they were, really genuinely excited to see Prabhupada with his foreign disciples coming through there. It was very nice. So then, December the 19th then, that was the next day. So this is the first day of the scheduled Pratishthan meeting. After breakfast, we were driven out in convoy to Pona for the inauguration at Paramdharma Ashram. So the night before, we'd been taken out to see this gentleman, Vinoba Bhave, who was at that time probably considered the leading spiritual personality in India, because he had been very closely associated with Gandhi. And they basically said that if anybody had understood Gandhiism, it was Vinoba Bhave. And after Gandhi's disappearance, then in the 1950s, he went on a campaign to give land to the landless people, the poor people. And he had gone off on a padyatra. And they started off, I don't know exactly where, but they went off, they walked to one village, they had a meeting, and then some people that had a lot of land came forward and said, I'll give an acre of land for the poor people. So then somebody else said, I'll give an acre. Like that, over the next few years, they walked all over India, and everywhere they went, people came forward and gave land. And about 5 million acres of land was pledged in this, I just forget the technical name, they had a name for it, for this yatra that they were doing. In the event, about 2 or 3 million acres was actually given. The others were just promises. But anyway, Vinoba Bhave became famous because of that. Then he retired to Pona, which was again very close to Wardha. Gandhi's place was 5 miles in one direction, and Bhave's place was 5 miles in the other direction from Wardha. So Pona is right on the river Dham. And so he had his ashram right on the edge of the river. And he had called it Param Dharma Ashram. So the meeting was to be held in an unadorned but large hall, about 60 feet by 20. Its roof simply corrugated asbestos on a steel frame. Representatives of a variety of spiritual and pseudo-spiritual groups, influential businessmen and ex-politicians, along with other observers numbering about 200, were already sitting on mats on the floor before a small stage which had been erected at one end especially for the meeting. Prabhupada entered, and as one of the three keynote speakers, he was led up onto the stage to occupy an asana alongside Vinoba Bhave and Swami Chidananda from the Divine Life Society. Chidananda is also staying at the same guest house as us at Bajaj Wadi in Wardha, in the room next to Srila Prabhupada, and he had travelled in the same car with us to the venue. He has met Srila Prabhupada once before in the West. Before any speaking, the meeting commenced with the chanting of the Vishnu Sahasranam, the 1,000 names of Lord Vishnu, by a large group of young women, all disciples of Bhave. It added a nice spiritual touch, and it took about 20 minutes. After just a few minutes, then there was some speaking. Vinoba Bhave spoke for 10 minutes. We were supposed to finish at, I think, 12:15. And then Prabhupada was asked to speak, and then Chidananda was going to speak at the end. So, you know, Bhave spoke for 10 minutes. Then Prabhupada got up, and he spoke for about 50 minutes. And he just started getting into them about, you know, if you want to preach Bhagavad Gita, you have to know what the Bhagavad Gita is. If you don't accept Krishna in the way that Arjuna accepted Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all your preaching is bogus. Like, and he was really getting into them. It was all in Hindi, but I could, you know, from a few key words, I could understand what he was saying. And Prabhupada had actually been preparing for this meeting for about 2 weeks beforehand. And he had been told, now Bhave is stone deaf. So if you want to ask him any questions or have any, you know, verbal intercourse with him, you'll have to write everything down. So Prabhupada made this list of about 32 different points that he wanted to bring up with him, and it was all the same stuff. How did Arjuna understand the Bhagavad Gita? Who is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead? You know, modern civilization means digging your own grave. You know, service to man is service to God is a modern fallacy. And stuff like this. And he would have these headings and then answer them with, you know, a verse from the Gita and some extra stuff that he was adding in. So anyway, we didn't get a chance to present that to Bhave the first evening. And then the next day then we were at this meeting. So Prabhupada just took full advantage. And he sat there for 50 minutes. He was just hammering them on these different points. So at the end, it was getting so late, it was nearly the finish of the meeting. And Chidananda was sitting there, he was completely nonplussed, he was really put out. And then finally Prabhupada stopped, and he didn't even bother to look at Chidananda. Chidananda was so annoyed that he said, there's not much time left, so I won't take up much of your time, because you have other things to do. And he said, and there may be other speakers. And he knew, of course, there were no other speakers. He was the last one. But he was trying to tell Prabhupada, I was next, and you didn't give me, you took my time up. Anyway, Prabhupada just ignored him. So after a few minutes, Chidananda had to stop, and the meeting ended at 12:15 p.m. We returned in the car to the guest house. Srila Prabhupada, Chidananda, and another man sitting in the back, with Jagadish and myself in front with the driver. As we travelled along the 5 miles back to Bajaj Wadi, Chidananda, sitting in the middle, launched into a eulogy of Bhave, enthusiastically describing his plans for spreading the message of the Gita to the masses. He began to speak about Bhave's latest attempts at social reform, his creation of the Women's Power Awakening Movement, which appears to be a kind of Gandhian version of women's liberation. Chidananda declared that Bhave had understood what the world needs as love, compassion, and sensitivity in order to change it to the good. Because all these qualities are naturally found in women, he said, Bhave therefore had a program to train any young woman from the age of 16 to 20 years for a 7-year period in his ashram. They learned to chant Sanskrit and the Vishnu Sahasranam. They're all trained in the Shastra, the principles of cleanliness, how to organize family life, etc. They choose a district in India where they will work, learn the local language, and at the end of the 7-year period, they have to travel to that place on foot, vehicular conveyance being forbidden. On arrival, they're supposed to go from one village to another and organize the women into groups and teach them by personal example how to be clean, how to run their families, and so forth. Bhave's idea is that if there is a good atmosphere at home, then the men will be naturally pacified. So in other words, it's the men that cause all the wars. So if the women keep them happy, they won't have anything to fight about, because, you know, they'll be happy at home and then they'll be peaceful. That was the idea. It's a laudable enough endeavor, no doubt, and completely mundane. Hardly the real essence of the teachings of the Gita, as Prabhupada pointed out. During the time that Chidananda was speaking, Prabhupada had mostly been looking out of the window with obvious disinterest. Chidananda was sitting in the middle, Prabhupada was sitting on the left, right next to the door, and the other guy was on the other side, so Prabhupada was just looking out like this. He had, at the beginning of Chidananda's laudations, pointed out that the Gita was actually for the leaders of human society, and only if they take it seriously can society be changed for the good. He quoted Rajashi. Yeah, you have to be Raja and Rishi. But Chidananda wouldn't hear him out, and he was determined to have his say, so he'd been stopped from speaking on the stage there, so now he was going to be heard like this. So finally, as Chidananda slowed down a bit, Prabhupada turned to him and he said, "The thing is, you can imagine any plan you like, but the fact is, Stri Shudra Dwijabandhunam, these are the less intelligent class of human beings, and they cannot preach Bhagavad Gita. Of course, if the women are devotees, then it is different." Chidananda, having already been affronted in the assembly hall, cuttingly replied, "Well, of course, the masses are less intelligent, so the path of devotion is naturally the only way for them. Because they have no knowledge, they can only be engaged in bhakti." It was the classic envious accusation that the Mayavadis that the Mayavadis impute on the devotees. We were now hearing the same criticism that Prakashananda Saraswati had leveled at Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu nearly 500 years ago, that bhakti is only for the less intelligent, and that when one becomes more intelligent, then he engages in speculative studies of Vedanta Sutra. Prabhupada replied this time with a great deal of labored patience. "I have already explained that the Gita is for the Rajashis, the leaders of society, who are also great saintly persons." But Chidananda simply closed his ears and would not allow Prabhupada to continue. He was determined to be heard and to hear his own voice. Having been denied the opportunity to speak at the meeting, he now imposed himself on the rest of us in the car with his praise of the non-devotees. Prabhupada simply turned away and looked out of the window again and did not bother to engage him in conversation again or listen to him. It was quite obvious that he was uncomfortable even having to sit in the same car as him. It was an interesting meeting. So then in the afternoon, at 5 p.m, Sriman Narayan, who was very friendly and respectful to Srila Prabhupada, came in a car to escort him to the Gandhi Ashram at Sevagram, a village about 5 miles from here, in the opposite direction to Pune. This ashram was Gandhi's headquarters for almost 10 years and his main respite. Whenever he felt too strained by politics, He would retreat here and spend his time spinning cotton on a small spinning wheel. As Prabhupada stepped out of his car, he was garlanded with the tradition in the traditional Gandhian fashion, not with flowers, but with a thick white loop of spun cotton thread. This was another means by which Gandhi propagated his idea of everybody spinning and weaving his own cloth in the simple self-sufficient style of millennia. Srila Prabhupada was escorted on a tour by Sriman Narayan, who, like many others present, was attired in a white khadi dhoti, kurta, khadi sleeveless jacket, and a small white cotton hat pointed at the front and the back, known more popularly in the West as a Nehru hat. The whole complex was originally Jamanlal Bajaj's property. He had turned it over to Gandhi in the early 1930s, and Gandhi came to stay here for the first time in 1936. His last stay was in 1946. The village itself was originally called Shigon, but it was renamed Sevagram in 1940. In all, on and off, Gandhi spent about 7 years in residence here at the height of the independence movement. Sevagram was thus naturally the center of action in the recent history of India. And nowadays, various institutions dedicated to Gandhi and his wife have sprung up in the village, such as Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Medical Science, which is allopathic, and the Kasturba Health Society. They give the name, but there's nothing else that resembles, you know, what was really going on. As Prabhupada was taken on a tour of the compound, I was surprised to see a complete absence of flower beds and gardens. It seems that when Gandhi first came here, the whole area was quite remote and difficult to access by road. Hemmed in by jungle, it was infested with snakes. After clearing the land, it was either gritted with fine pebbles or kept as bare earth in an effort to keep away the unwanted reptiles. There is also no electricity, because Gandhi had apparently made a vow that he would not allow electricity until every village in India had it, and so all the lighting to this day is done with kerosene lamps. The accent was on simple village life and rural economic occupations, and the buildings with their mud brick walls and bamboo and red tiled roofs reflected this. We finally ended up at the small group of cottages where Gandhi himself had lived. His original residence was a one-room hut called Adi Nivas. Built by the local villagers, Gandhi had instructed them not to spend more than 500 rupees. It is small and simple, with a 2 feet thick mud walls, smooth mud floor covered with woven cane mats, and a tiled roof. Water was drawn from a well, and Gandhi would bathe in a tin bath. When things got too busy due to political dealings, Gandhi later moved with his wife Kasturba into a larger hut nearby, which became known as Bapu Kuti. When that got too busy, Kasturba was given a hut of her own called Ba Kuti. Another hut became Bapu's office, and this had a telephone with a hotline to Delhi. So, despite his attempts at simple living, politics were never far behind. Surrounding these huts are other similar huts which are occupied by Gandhi's married followers. To live in the ashram, all the residents had to observe 11 strict codes of behavior: truth, satya; non-violence, ahimsa; chastity, brahmacharya; non-possession; non-stealing; bread labor, whatever that is; control of palate; fearlessness; equality of religions; swadeshi, or the use of home-produced goods; and removal of untouchability. So they were the 11 principles. Srila Prabhupada was invited to sit inside Bapu Kuti for a few minutes. This has a central room with Gandhi's seat and a spinning wheel, and on two walls there is a bas-relief in mud of the Om sign flanked by palm trees. The mud floor is covered with bamboo matting, and a bamboo bookcase displays the Gita, Koran, Bible, Ramayana, and devotional songs of various saints. There is also an urn that bore Gandhi's ashes after his cremation. The ashes themselves were put in the River Dham at Pune. As a footnote there, why put it in that river and not the, you know, I mean, he was cremated in Delhi. And, of course, the Jamuna's right there. And I think one of the reasons was, because that was their headquarters there at Pune. But apart from that, Gandhi didn't believe in holy places. He didn't believe that there was any such thing as a special place that you could go to that was any more sanctified than anywhere else. And he didn't believe in bathing in holy rivers either. So, anyway. After a brief inspection of the rooms, Prabhupada was led outside to an open area in the center of the compound. Sectioned off by a low single rail fence, it is used for the daily ritual of meditation and prayer recital. A large sign at one end declared in Hindi and English, "Prayer Ground." This is the place where Bapu, Mahatma Gandhi, used to hold prayers both morning and evening and shared his thoughts with those present. Quote, "It should be a spacious ground under the open sky available to the poorest of the poor." Unquote. Daily prayer is still held on this ground. And then another smaller sign announced, "Do not walk with shoes." It was by now dusk, and about 50 men and women with a few small children had gathered to sit in neat rows facing an asana which was formerly used by Gandhi. To the accompaniment of the strums of a single veena, they all solemnly chanted some Buddhist mantras in Japanese, then observed 2 minutes silence, then recited the last 19 verses of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, followed by prayers from the Quran in Urdu, prayers from the Bible, and then the Zarathustra in Parsi, then some devotional songs by Mirabai and Tulsi Das, and then chanted Ram Dhun, or the names of God, and ended with a short reading from the Ramayana. It took about half an hour, and in comparison to our kirtans, to me at least, it sounded funereal. Prabhupada sat quietly through the whole rendition, and at the end, he was asked to sign the visitor's book. He willingly did so, and inside he wrote, "I was fortunate to come to the Gandhi Ashram Sevagram today. It is so quiet and serene. I have requested them to chant Hare Krishna." Maha Mantra. Reading it out for all to hear, he then signed it with his familiar A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. If you go there, that book is still there. You can still see that message from Prabhupada. Just before he got up to leave, Nirmala Ben, the wife of Gandhi's third son, Ramdas, came and spoke a few friendly words. They enjoyed a pleasant 5 minute exchange, and then it was time to leave. Prabhupada approached the waiting car. As he went to step into the front seat, I held the door open for him. Moving forward and turning to enter with his back first, Prabhupada said, without irony and out aloud to nobody in particular, "Nirvisesha Shunyavadi." And then he got in and left. It was a fitting observation and commentary of his visit. When we got back to his room, he chatted for a while about the visit, and he said that they, the followers of Gandhi, can try to keep the tradition, but there is no life, and gradually the whole thing will be useless and finished. He said that simply on the basis of some sentiment, they are carrying out their rituals, but it will not survive. And he noted that there were no young people at the place, only infants and middle-aged men and women who were old enough to remember Gandhi and still have some sentiment. So that was the first full day. Then the next day, on December the 20th, in the morning, Prabhupada went for a walk in the local in the grounds of the local college. He, Jagadish, and myself were accompanied by a young Indian man who is a member of Chidananda's ashram. As we set off, he had approached Srila Prabhupada and asked if he could accompany us, and Prabhupada agreed. He told Prabhupada a little about his background. When he had first moved into the ashram, he said, he was always chanting the names of God. Day and night he could do so with no effort, and he always felt enthusiastic. But now, even with great effort, it was difficult for him to continue. How, he asked Srila Prabhupada, would it be possible to regain that spontaneity? Prabhupada said it was all dependent on association. He told him, if you live with others that chant, then you can chant. The boy persisted a little with his questions, so Prabhupada asked him what went on at his ashram. The boy explained that Chidananda's idea was that everybody should be allowed to come and live at the ashram and do whatever attracted them. Some people chant, some people do this kind of yoga, some people another. Oh, a hodgepodge, Prabhupada said wryly. And he told him, because the people you are living with are not bhaktas, they are yogis, then advancement will be difficult. Yoga means there is some selfish desire. Later on in the morning at 9 a.m, whilst he was taking his massage, Prabhupada said that it was significant that the boy was coming to him for the answers to his questions. This means that all others are simply bluffers and cheaters, he said. Our men are not going to them for answers. They are perfectly satisfied with Krishna consciousness. Okay, then one final little thing on that Gita Pratisthan meeting. So in the morning, it was the last day, and then they were having what they called a workshop meeting in the morning, where they were going to try to figure out, you know, practical things to do to popularize the Bhagavad Gita in India. So they told Prabhupada, no need for you to come, and we'll call you when we've finished. We'll read to you what we've, what ideas we've got, and then you can give us your feedback. So we were waiting then. I'd given Prabhupada his massage early because he was told in the morning it would begin with this workshop discussion, and that would enable the working committee to formulate their plans, and he would not be required to attend. Ramakrishna Bajaj told Prabhupada that they would call him at the end and then read the results to him for their comments. So the time of his attendance was not fixed up. By 10:30 he was still waiting, and I told Prabhupada that perhaps they weren't going to call him at all. It doesn't matter, he said. It's better that we don't go. They are all impersonalists anyway, and I do not care for their company. I smiled at Prabhupada's supremely independent position. He is simply concerned with pleasing Krishna, and he has no interest in submitting himself to the company of sentimentalists and Mayavadis. He talked for quite some time, strongly criticizing them. He said they have little idea of what is actually spiritual. And he observed that Vinoba Bhave has spent the last 40 years, and all he has done is gather up a few women to chant the Vishnu Sahasranam. And they say, oh, he is a great man. So, anyway, and then after that, there was the actual Prabhupada got called in, and then he roasted them again for another half hour. And then that was the end of it. Okay, so it's 10 to 7. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah. To give what?
Asked me the blessing of the devotees in Mayapur, because he is making one traveling, one small boat, a plastic, from Yamuna Vrindavan until Mayapur Ganga. Entonces, if he starts this traveling 12 September, and if he thinks he can arrive to Mayapur in 1 month, but I don't know. I asked him, I make one video.
What is he? He's traveling from Vrindavan to Mayapur.
Vrindavan until Ganga Mayapur.
On a boat.
Yes.
A small plastic boat.
The I made one video, and I asked to him, but how is possible you can arrive to Mayapur with this? And he told me, with the blessing of the devotees. With the blessing of the devotees.
How big is the boat?
Now I don't know where it is. I don't know if he can arrive. Okay, I just think.
Now, how big is the boat?
From here until there.
All right, so Mahavishnu Swami means the white one, not the Indian one. Mahavishnu. Which one?
White,
white, white. The white one. There's two Mahavishnu Swamis. One is an Indian, one is a Westerner.
Western.
The Westerner, okay. All right, so Mahavishnu Swami is setting off, or has set off, on September the 16th from Vrindavan in a dinghy. And he's going to attempt to sail all the way down the Jamuna onto the Ganga and arrive here in Mayapur by when? In 1 month.
He said in 1 month.
Maybe 1 month.
Well, is he coming so, with some devotees? With some rules devotees, the majority of the rules, very strong devotees.
Irish Parasaram, who does the food relief, he does the padiyatra for the Braj Mandala Parikrama. He goes around and distributes food, free food, every year there. So just the two of them? Just the two of them? Just two of them?
Like four or five devotees. Four or five devotees. Maybe one be there.
Okay. So they want the blessings of the devotees in Mayapur so they can arrive safely.
They can arrive to the temple.
Okay, let's chant Hare Krishna for the successful mission. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Mahavishnu Maharaj Ki Jai. Okay. Nandi Kishore has an announcement.
Okay, so tomorrow we are going to do a quiz on Srila Prabhupada's Lilamrita. Whatever we have been hearing so far from His Grace Harisarva Prabhu, all you have to do is bring one pencil or pen. And we will give you the competition, like will last 15 minutes, and you have to answer 10 questions. It's an objective type of questions, everything about Srila Prabhupada. So you have a whole day to prepare. Bring all your friends or devotees, and there are top 3 prizes to be won. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? You have to speak a bit louder. Shh. I can't hear.
When you were arriving in France and there was that man who was nasty.
Yeah.
And had that little temple with Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
And he was speaking to you and praying. Did he know you? Because he obviously knew your name.
No, when he said Harry, it was a.
It
means for Hare Krishna. How are you, Harry? Didn't mean, how are you, Harry? Sorry. Just coincidence, that one. It's like in Australia. Oh, the Harrys are here. Yeah. Yeah. Pratishna. Chid Ananda. He was from the Divine Life Mission. No. Chid Ananda from the Divine Life Mission. He met Prabhupada once, I think, in Hawaii. And when Yogi Bhajan and there was some other spiritual leader, they are three of them, they went there to invite Prabhupada. Was it in Hawaii or was it in Berkeley? I have to check that. But anyway, they went there and invited Prabhupada to come to a world peace conference And Prabhupada said, no. He said, there will never be peace. He said, it's all bogus. Plus the fact that he didn't like going with Mayavadis anyway. So, any other questions or comments? Oh, the ghosts. Well, I moved that further down, so it'll come up in the next day or two. And the dancing session comes up towards the end of the seminar. We've still got a bit left yet, but we're about 3/4 of the way through, so we'll do it in the next couple of days. Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.